An in-depth look at the engaging debate on US, China, and global issues. This is The Heat.
The IMF World Bank Spring Meetings. What's on the agenda? Hello, I'm Mike Walter, filling in for Anna Naidu, and this is The Heat. Finance leaders from around the world continue their World Bank IMF spring meetings in Washington. Participants know that China will play a crucial role in global growth in the coming years. CGTN's Jim Spellman explains.
The global economy has been resilient despite recent challenges from the pandemic, military conflicts in Ukraine and Gaza, and global inflation.
Despite these multiple shocks and tight financial conditions, growth is firmly in positive territory. And we have slightly upgraded our forecast for this year to 3.2%.
Asia, and particularly China, will play a large role in global growth in the years ahead, according to IMF projections. Despite lingering concerns, largely centered around the real estate sector, China's first quarter GDP growth came in higher than projected.
China's GDP grew by 5.3% in the first quarter of 2024 amid a broad-based expansion. The outturn was higher than what staff had projected and also what market had projected. So any upside to Chinese growth will have a bearing on countries in Asia. In general, the region will continue to do better when China grows faster.
The IMF is closely observing policy reforms underway in China. CGTN's Wang Xiaozhou asked the IMF's managing director about her recent trip to China.
I'd love to know more about your takeaways from that trip and also from your firsthand experience and observations, how you think China can hit its growth target this year.
I had an opportunity to visit China and discuss with Chinese leadership how they think about growth prospects for the country. Number one, to shift the economy more towards domestic consumption. It is actually in line with what China is aspiring, the dual circulation economy. Secondly, we see the reforms in China that have served the country well continuing to be needed. Reforms to state-owned enterprises, opening up for more competitive environment.
Threats to the global economy remain, including potential increases in protectionist trade policies and the risk that geopolitical tensions between China and the U.S. could lead to a fragmentation between the world's two largest economies. Economists here at the IMF say such a fragmentation could create a drag on the entire global economy. Jim Spellman, CGTN, Washington.
Central Asia's economy is also an area of interest. The region's economy expanded by more than 5% last year. Growth is expected to drop this year, but it will pick up again in 2025. For more on Central Asia's economy, Anna Naidu spoke to Nikolai Podguzov, the chairman of the Eurasian Development Bank.
The Eurasian Development Bank is a sub-regional bank which operates mainly in Central Asia. Kazakhstan is one of our main shareholders. Other countries like Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and hopefully Uzbekistan very soon our members or potential members. Central Asia is the main focus of our activity, and we invest almost $1.5 billion each year into this region. Very interesting region with a lot of challenges. Most of the countries are landlocked or double landlocked. That is why it's very important to improve connectivity of the region.
What's the outlook when you look at some of the headwinds that are facing not just your region but the globe right now? Things like high inflation, conflict in many areas, slow growth around the world?
The situation globally is quite complicated, and we see that different parts of the world has different pace of growth, inflation, etc. As for the Central Asian region, I think that they demonstrate above expectations and above average growth rates. For example, Kazakhstan's growth exceeded 5% last year, but president of the country, Kasym Jomart Kemelevich Tokayev, is not satisfied with this pace of growth and looking for pace higher than 6%. And this pace could be met only through additional investments into infrastructure, into the diversifying of economy. And we try to help with this investment plan.
Right, as you point out, Chinese companies are involved in the region. What kind of impact have those Chinese investments had?
The accumulated Chinese investments into the region amount to $56 billion, which is a significant amount given the size of Central Asian economies. Almost half of these investments accumulated in Kazakhstan, but investments in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan are also quite solid. We have a lot of projects in infrastructure, in petrochemical, where Chinese companies are very much interested. We participate in a number of hydropower projects where Chinese companies participate. A number of projects in transport infrastructure where Chinese companies are very much interested. We have a number of cross-border projects between Kazakhstan and China in logistics, where we also see very huge interest from Chinese companies.
Right. Now, I understand the bank has adopted Islamic financial principles and practices. What is the advantage of that?
For us, it's very important to develop Islamic finance in the region, as most of the Central Asian countries, all Central Asian countries are Muslim countries. That is why it is quite natural to develop Islamic finance principles within the region. As of now, the penetration of Islamic finance in the region is not that high. But I believe that until 2030-35, the general Islamic finance portfolio in the region could exceed $10 billion. We have significant demand from companies for Islamic financing, and we plan to develop this source of financing and this approach to do projects in the region.
Now let's take a closer look at the International Monetary Fund World Bank spring meetings taking place right here in Washington, D.C. Joining us now from Beijing is John Gong. He's a professor at the University of International Business and Economics in Beijing. With us, too, from Oregon is Yan Liang. She's a chair professor in economics at Willamette University. And also joining the discussion from Tokyo is John Quelch. He's a professor and executive vice chancellor at Duke Kunshan University. And we want to welcome all of you to the show. John Gong, let me start with you. I thought that was a really interesting conversation because, as he pointed out, you know, there's so many limitations when you're landlocked, or as he said, double landlocked. And he talked about the importance of not just infrastructure, but China as well. Can you talk a little bit about your takeaways from that interview?
Actually, I've been to Kazakhstan, been to Almaty and the capital city, Astana. For countries like Kazakhstan and other neighboring countries that are landlocked, connectivity to the world, infrastructure, transportation infrastructure is critically important. And I think one thing in the past that can be testified to say that the these kind of infrastructure is indeed important is the railway connection between China and to Europe, which passes this region. And I think the operation of the many trains between Europe and China also have been bringing a lot of benefits to these countries. We're starting to see more and more trade increasing between China and these, in China we call them stan countries, Kazakhstan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, these former Soviet Republic countries. I think there's a fair amount of growth among these countries, and also there's a fair amount of investment from Chinese companies in this region. So I think recently there is a major initiative, infrastructure, transportation infrastructure initiative in cooperation between these countries to further link these countries to outside markets in other parts of the world. So absolutely, you're right. Infrastructure connectivity is so much important for these countries.
Jan, let me ask you about some of the information that came in Jim's package. Of course, the IMF, this uptick in terms of global growth, just slightly, the 3.2%, that's just a little bit above what they were saying in January. But I guess anything going up is a good sign. What's your takeaway from that?
Right. Good to talk to you, Mike. I agree. I think, any improvements in global growth, especially post-pandemic and with the geopolitical, tensions and conflicts around, it's always a good sign. But we need to be humble. This 3.2% of growth projection is still much lower than the average before the pandemic. And I think the problem is also, the divergence, right, that the United States is doing very well, China, of course. By the way, they're still upholding the 4.6% of the growth forecast for China, and that's because I think they were still not be able to incorporate the first quarter growth number in their estimate. So at their WEO release meeting, they did mention they may actually upgrade China's growth forecast going forward. But again, I think the problem is, the IMF talked about the four potential risks, right, that the inflation is still not defeated, and that has great implications on, monetary policy. They also talked about the depletion of fiscal buffers. They also talked about, the continued geopolitical tensions, and finally, the very slow investments and actions on climate change. So I think all of these, risks would really cloud, right, the growth prospect going forward. And I think, with all these very important meetings going on, they should provide better guidance for countries to implement monetary policy, fiscal policy, as well as especially, how it really helps to, for the developing countries when it comes to, the debt distress that is now facing close to 60% of the low-income countries, as well as the lack of, finance for development and also for climate.
Yeah, John Quelch, let's talk a little bit more about this, because when you look at the dynamics that are out there at play, when she mentioned the multiple shocks, COVID, inflation, you've got climate change. The developing nations are the ones that are really taking it on the chin. Can you talk a little bit about that, and what's the solution? Or is there one?
Sure, Mike. Thank you. Global debt totally is around about $300 trillion at this point. And debt has been increasing faster in emerging than in advanced economies, especially during the last few years of the pandemic stress. What we have therefore seen in conjunction with the IMF meetings is the sovereign debt roundtable looking very closely at how to mitigate debt overload problems for countries like Zambia and Ghana, Sri Lanka, other countries that have got into serious debt trouble. With the United States still holding interest rates strong in order to fight inflation, dollar-denominated debt held by the emerging economies carries an interest burden that maybe was not foreseen when it was contracted pre-pandemic. So there is a significant debt overhang burden for emerging economies, and that's something that is part of the agenda, especially of R.J. Banger, the World Bank president, who made a point from the outset during his tenure of wanting to focus on increasing economic growth in the global south.
And John Gong, these emerging economies facing these headwinds, are there solutions that are likely to come out of Washington, D.C., do you think?
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult. I think the previous expectation is that the interest rate is going to be dropping. The inflation picture is getting improved in the United States, but the latest round of a CPI number coming out is not that good, actually. So I think the market expectations of interest rate drop is all but dissipated. I think especially unlikely because inflation is such a, fighting inflation is such an important issue in the presidential election this time. I think, and we've been seeing a lot of complaints from the average folks, people in the United States, complaining about the prices of groceries, complaining about the prices of gas stations, complain about the high rental costs, for example. And this is a very, very important issue in the election. So I think, from the Biden's administration's perspective, I really don't think that they're going to decrease interest rate anytime soon. So that continues the problem that John was talking about. The debt burden carried by these debt-ridden developing countries, and that's a big problem. So I think, this situation is not going to get improved anytime soon, unfortunately.
Yeah, let me ask you a little bit more about China, because that was also a focus, the GDP coming in higher than expected. So a couple of questions. What's driving China's growth early on in the year, do you see? And then also, when we think of China, it has an impact. You know, we talked about Central Asia. It has an impact in the region and the world. I mean, if the growth comes up, it rises other boats, as they say. Talk to us about that.
Well, if you look at the GDP growth figure and break it down, the growth is mostly coming from the manufacturing sector, actually. This is a very good sign, I think. The service sector is already getting strong after the pandemic era. And now manufacturing seems to be picking up, investment seems to be picking up. So I think, these growth figures provide some opportunities. This is actually corroborated by the quite significant increase in electricity usage here in China. And we know that the electricity usage is highly correlated with GDP growth. So what it means is that the real economy, here we call it the real economy, the manufacturing economy, is picking up speed. And I think, the opportunities presented to other countries will be in the form of, increased imports and also, I would say, increased travels by Chinese tourists overseas. And I think this area is really picking up. And I see, the flight tickets, the bookings in foreign countries by Chinese tourists are really going up pretty significantly. So these are great opportunities for the rest of the world.
And Yan, contributing to that, China's eased some of these visa restrictions on some of these countries, which will probably add to travel as well, wouldn't you say?
Right, I do think so. I think, these visa-free kind of, removing these restrictions is definitely helping to bring more tourists to China. I've seen stats about, for example, European tourists have increased by 60% year on year at the beginning of this year. So I think it is helpful. But I think, of course, China also contributes to the world by, exporting some of the very essential techs, especially, green products, green tech. That would help really to accelerate, green transition in the rest of the world. Also, China's outbound investment, for example, under Belt Road Initiative that you mentioned earlier, that is also very helpful to boost the connectivity. And that also, in turn, helped China. When you look at China's first quarter trade with the BRI countries, that has gone up by 5.5%, and it's now accounting for, over 46% of China's total trade. So I think, this is a great sign. It's a mutual benefit. As China grows faster, it also helps the rest of the world to make the green transition and also grow faster. I just wanted to make one point, I think, in terms of what is the solution, to the least developing countries right now. I think we all know what the solution is. The matter is, is there a political will? Is there, good economic policies, when it comes to the rate hikes in the United States? I understand sort of the whole idea of a last mile, a battle against inflation, but I really don't know how much this interest rate, you know, keep higher for longer scenario would really help to reduce inflation. In the United States, inflation is mostly driven by shelter, by car insurance, when you look at, the specific reasons. And none of this is really matter for, the high interest rates. High interest rates is not going to really reduce those kinds of inflation. But that high interest rate is really putting a lot of burdens on these developing countries with external debt service. That is over $600 billion a year in terms of debt service and principal repayments. Not to mention, the currency depreciation that, again, puts extra burden on these developing countries. And I'm also worried about, this long-term investment cost, especially for renewable energies, that is going to be higher due to this higher cost of borrowing.
Yeah, it's obviously a serious problem out there. John Quelch, another problem that appears kind of on the horizon as a potential issue, at least, is protectionist trade policies. Do you see that as a complication as well?
Certainly, it's been evident in the last decade. Whenever you have an economic downturn in a country, it appears now to be fashionable to shift into protectionist mode, which, of course, is exactly what economists will tell you is the wrong thing to do in the face of a looming recession or downturn. During any election year, we expect to see rhetoric that is more protectionist, more nationalist, and that can only be a headwind for global economic growth. So just one point on the inflation front. I do think that it's important to remember that Chairman Powell was very slow off the mark in terms of fighting inflation in the first place, dismissing it as a temporary or transitional phenomenon. And I think he's determined in terms of his own legacy to get the inflation rate down to the steady state, the holy grail, if you like, of 2%, rightly or wrongly.
Jan, we've had two Johns kind of weigh in on elections, and I want to give you a chance to talk about elections too, because this is, I think Time magazine called it the ultimate election year. Globally, we're going to see elections in 64 countries and the European Union. And when you're campaigning, you don't really want to talk about debt or fiscal deficits. You want to talk about other things. And that's one of the messages coming from the meetings here in Washington is, restraint. That's not a message you're likely to see out on the campaign trail. How is all of these elections going to impact all of this, do you think?
Right. So I think, the idea that it's time for government to rebuild their fiscal buffers amid this kind of election year, I think that would be very difficult to do. And I also don't necessarily buy in this idea that, especially for countries like the United States or Germany, for that matter, that they really need to rein in their fiscal spending. They're spending in their own sovereign currency. I don't think they're going to run out of the euros or the dollars anytime soon that they have to rein in their spending. But definitely there is the political pressure. But I agree with John Quelch. That's this idea that because of the election year, because there will be a lot more talk about protectionism. So you hear what Biden was saying, that he wants to triple the tariff on Chinese exports of steel to the United States and aluminum products. Given the fact that, China only accounts for about 2% of the U.S. total imports of steel. So you can see these kinds of talks about protectionism, it's really, politically motivated, right? Trying to win the hearts of the union members of, Pennsylvania. So I think we're going to see more sort of tense political rhetorics about protectionism. But at the end of the day, I think, the markets, businesses, the people are not going to, welcome this kinds of protectionism. The IMF has warned, this kinds of geopolitical fermentation is going to shed 7% of the GDP going forward. And they have already showed some reports about, between blocks, we have seen 12% decline of trade and 20% decline of FDI. So that is clearly not making, the supply chain either more efficient or more resilient. So I think, it's very important to separate the political rationalities from the economic reality.
Well, it's a fascinating discussion. I can't thank the three of you enough. We'll keep our eyes on the events that are taking place here in Washington, D.C. Thank you all for your analysis. Really appreciate it. And that's going to do it for this special edition of The Heat. Thanks for joining us.